Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
The conventional wisdom is, and we hear it repeated again and again and again whenever education comes up, is that religious beliefs are at the very least a potential barrier to a good education. And if you're really fervent in your beliefs and practices, you're probably going to believe things that will make it hard for you to get a decent education. It's going to stand in the way. Does that conventional wisdom, does it bear the light of scrutiny? Does it bear itself out in actual research with students themselves who, at varying degrees, have religious affiliation, beliefs, and involvement? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about a new study from Stanford University on religious faith and academic achievement. Ariel Davidson joins us. She is an economic research assistant at the Hoover Institution in Palo Alto, California, and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled Stanford Study, The Most Religious Kids Do Best in School. Ariel, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How do you respond to the rather wide-held assumption that religious beliefs and religious involvement are going to serve as an obstacle to a kid's education?
Well, I think this paper is a pretty hallmark paper in terms of pointing out, you know, there are certain qualities which an adolescent gains from being part of a religious community, from regularly practicing religion, and those two qualities are pointed out as being cooperation and conscientiousness. And our school system tends to reward the children who are able to be conscientious and cooperative. And I think society as a whole does as well. And so when you hear parents say, you know, religion is something that's going to be an obstacle for my child's success, I think it's quite the opposite. And I think there's quite a bit of data to show that. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about being part of a larger community and all the sort of benefits that you get from religion, not just on an intellectual level, but on an emotional and a personal level as well. And this paper doesn't necessarily go into those qualities as much. It really just focuses more on this conscientiousness and ability to work alongside others. But I do think that when you go through this paper, you'll start to see how a lot of the children who the researcher had the privilege of interviewing spoke very much about their own personal behaviors and how religion was actually a guiding principle in terms of determining whether they would do something out of character or out of line or something for which they might feel guilt. And I think that was really interesting because in a lot of ways, religion is how, you know, parents are able to transmit a good value system. And this paper doesn't argue that it's necessary. It just argues that it's sufficient. However, I think it's worth noting that, you know, there isn't any alternative to religion pointed out in the paper, right? So if we argue that religion is something that is sufficient for transmitting values to your children, that's a very fair statement. I think is where it gets thorny is when you say it's necessary. But like I said, this paper, you know, doesn't offer any alternatives to religion. And I think that's a significant point to make as well.
Tell us about the Stanford Graduate School study on this. How was it conducted and how did it treat the data?
Right. So the study itself was performed on a little over 3,000 adolescents in the early 2000s. The study was performed now, but the research or the data itself was taken in 2001 to 2002. And essentially what the researcher at Stanford did was she placed all the students into buckets based on their religiosity. And it's a spectrum ranging from the religious abiders all the way to the avoiders and then finally to the atheists who don't believe in God at all. And essentially what she wanted to see was, I want to see how much these individual students' religiosity is correlated to their GPA. And it was a very interesting result because in addition to looking at this survey data, she also went ahead and interviewed 30 different students engaged in qualitative interviews, really to get a sense of, you know, if there is a correlation, I want to understand what is the cause, if there is a causation as well as a correlation. and her results were fascinating. I think for the most part, her paper focuses on this abider-avoider achievement gap, as opposed to looking at religious abiders versus religious atheists, which I think is very interesting. She made a personal decision to avoid discussing atheists or making any conjecture about atheist students, I think mostly because they were such a small sample size. They were about 3% of the entire sample, and they were the only group that were not outperformed by these religious abiders, which is also kind of interesting. But she was very careful to not place the atheists in the same group as the religious avoiders, namely because the atheists have their own sort of unique set of qualities, especially if you're willing to openly declare at such a young age that you don't believe in God, in a country where I think there's a fair amount of social stigma surrounding that statement. So she made a conscious decision, and so the primary thrust of the paper is examining this very, very apparent achievement gap between across all income levels between avoiders and abiders. And abiders had an average GPA 3.21, while the avoiders had a GPA of 2.92. And what makes her paper, I think, fairly fascinating is the fact that when we talk about achievement gaps, most often we see achievement gaps discussed in the context of, you know, where can we throw more money at this problem? Or how much more government intervention do we need in order to close income achievement gaps? And here, she's exposing that there might be an existing religion achievement gap, which I just thought was fascinating, very much so.
What kind of qualities or characteristics did she find that were in contrast between the category of abiders and the category of avoiders when it came to religious involvement and their academic performance?
Right. So this is actually probably the most interesting part of the paper, because she was able to give very detailed insight into the interviews that she conducted with the students. What she noticed, and what I will recite back to you, is that the religious abiding students tended to be much more conscientious in their discussions of their own personal behavior. They were much more aware of when they acted out of character or when they rebelled and how they had felt guilt in those instances. When she spoke with the religious avoiders, she said, frankly, that there was really no discussion of conscientiousness, very little evidence of guilt, and really there was more of an embrace of rebellious behavior. And that to me was fascinating because, you know, I don't know her motivations necessarily in writing this paper, but I will say that to conduct interviews of this level and to really get insight into how students are behaving according to their religiosity, I thought was extremely interesting.
And what, if anything, does she do to address the question of whether or not it may simply be that high academic achievers or people who display these qualities that you had just mentioned are simply attracted to religion and religious involvement?
Right. And so she sort of addresses this issue of the chicken or the egg, saying it's highly unlikely that students were, the high-performing students were drawn to religion, mostly because religion is fairly non-voluntary in your adolescence. And so the focus of this study was on not just high school students, but middle school students as well. And so if we look at an average middle school student, I don't think they're going to have much say over whether they're going to church or synagogue in the morning. And so that was really how she addressed that issue of, you know, maybe the students are just attracted to, you know, maybe the high-performing students are just attracted to religion. And she says, I'm just not sure that's really the case here, because, again, religion is really not totally, is not a voluntary act when you're young. I mean, if your parents say you're going to church, you're going to church. And that's the end of it. That's how she addresses that issue. And I think that's a pretty good way to address it. Again, we could probably pick some hairs with the older children, you know, once you start to get to the latter years of high school. But, you know, I do think that she does address the correlation versus causation questions fairly well.
Does she tease out the nature of religious involvement? That is, does she distinguish between Protestants, Catholics, any of that kind of information?
She does. I believe it was Protestants that had the highest number of abiders, if I'm not mistaken. She does tease it out by race as well, and she does tease it out by income. What I thought was interesting about the income factor was that religiosity actually had the most impact on middle-income students and low-income students. And so when we think about, you know, the income gap in particular, which is really what this paper sort of comes up against or flies in the face of a bit, her ability to show that, you know, religiosity and the values that it transmits can have the most impact on students who might need it the most as well. And it might be a way to sort of address, when we think about the income gap, it might be another way to look at it. I thought that was very interesting as well.
You mentioned that Protestants, in particular conservative Protestants, fared well in academic achievement in this study. Does that surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me. I think what surprises me is that a lot of the discussion as of late, especially on the more left side of the spectrum, has been, you know, like as the question you asked earlier, is religion getting in the way of academia? You know, is religion getting in the way of academic pursuit? And I think what makes this paper, you know, and a lot of times as of late, especially on the left, people associate religion with ignorance. They've associated religion with all sorts of negative connotations. I myself am a conservative Jew, and, you know, I think religion as one of the fundamental things that has enlightened me and given me a sense of groundedness and has promoted my own understanding of the world in a really awesome and fantastic way. And to think that might be associated with ignorance is really shocking to me. So what I appreciate about this paper was it really challenges the notion that people who are particularly religious must be, you know, ignorant people who have no higher understanding of the world. And in fact, I think it's quite the opposite. So, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this paper on a personal level as well, which is why I was compelled to write a piece for the Federalist on it.
With regard to education reform, what implications does this have? What do you think we can learn from this study?
Right. So what I think this paper does supremely well is it shows that there's a lot of education reform that can take place at home. Education reform might as well start at home, right? If we think about the values that we're transmitting to our children, and before we send them to school, so much takes place in the home. And I think what this paper shows is that a good value system can be extremely beneficial to a child in terms of navigating the academic world. And so to me, that is really hugely important. And I hope that that's one of the main takeaways that people get from this paper and from my piece on it, is that when we think about education reform, we really need to think about what's going on at home and how that might impact the child. So much of education reform says we should just be throwing more money at the problem, right? That it's a lack of funding, or that, you know, it's just a matter of this income gap. When reality is that I think there's a lot that takes place at home that tremendously impacts how a child performs in the classroom. And I can't stress that enough. And I think that, you know, like I said earlier, religion is just one vehicle for transmitting a value system. Is it necessary? No. But I think what this paper shows is that it's tremendously sufficient.
Finally, then, does it have at least some corollary implications for further study into home life or family and its correlation with academic development?
Oh, I definitely think so. And, you know, there is some research done on that as well. But I think that in order to start to look at that research, we need to get people to really admit how much of a component home life could be. You know, I think it's hard because in some ways it's tougher to quantify someone's home life. And so I think what this paper was able to do was to look at like one hard facet, namely religion, and then able to put a quantitative value, assign a quantitative value to it, which is what made this paper effective. It's harder to do that with other metrics, which is why, you know, researchers often rely on household income, because it's just hard numbers that they can use. So I think moving forward, we might have to be creative about the type of metrics that we use in order to gauge an adolescent's home life. Now, I don't like to reduce everything to numbers, but I do think that sometimes numbers are helpful in terms of, like I said, assigning some kind of hard value that we can then use as a point to say, look, maybe we should be considering, you know, how much home life is impacting a student's GPA. I used to volunteer in Boston Public School Systems for 3 years in the inner city when I was in high school. And, you know, I got to see firsthand sort of how much a child is impacted by what's going on at home. And that to me was really mind-blowing, because as a high school student, I had no, you know, I didn't consider the possible impacts necessarily, or how much, you know, whatever might be going on at home, good or bad, can help or harm a student.
Arielle Davidson is an economic research assistant at the Hoover Institution in Palo Alto, California. She's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled Stanford Study, The Most Religious Kids Do Best in School. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Ariel, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed this.
When we come back in Hour 2 of Issues, etc. on this Thursday, April the 19th, we're going to talk about Islam and the Enlightenment. Again, here the conventional wisdom is simply that Islam was the gateway to the Enlightenment. Islam revived learning in Europe by reintroducing the ancients. Is it true? Dr. Alvin Schmidt, author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, will be our guest. Then we'll talk Marvel movies with Pastor Ted Geese.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.